On this week's 51%, singer-songwriter Ani DeFranco speaks with WAMC's Sarah LaDuke about her new record and her transition to Broadway.
I get it now. I'm not Ani. It's not about what is Ani doing. It's Persephone time, and I just go all the way there.
We also hear from the founder of the Victory Dance Project about the company's 10-year anniversary. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. A little update before we start. Shortly before we taped today's show, the Supreme Court struck down a lawsuit challenging the Food and Drug Administration's regulations for mifepristone, preserving access to one of two pills most commonly used in medication abortions in the U.S. We plan to break down the decision in full for you next week. This week, though, we've got a couple more artist interviews lined up for you. Our first guest has joined the program before. Singer-songwriter and feminist icon Ani DeFranco has a lot going on right now. She recently released her latest record, Unprecedented Shit, on her label Righteous Babe Records. A new documentary on her life called 1-800 On Her Own just premiered at Tribeca Film Festival. She's got a new children's book due in August. And through the end of this month, she is starring as Persephone in the Tony and Grammy Award-winning best musical Hadestown, 8 shows a week on Broadway. DeFranco actually sang the song Persephone on the original album back in 2010. She recently spoke with WAMC's Sarah LaDuke about all of this, starting with her new record, which saw DeFranco break away from her usual solo creative process.
Putting this record together was a long and meandering process. I was working with this incredible producer, BJ Burton, and he brought so much to the table and is such a big part of the sound of it. But he's also a wild card of a human who would sort of disappear for weeks and months at a time. And so I was just trying to go with it, go with the flow and not pressure the process, you know, not invent a deadline for myself, which is what I've done most of the time for the last 30 years, you know, just self-imposed. And I just let it play out naturally. And then at a certain point, again, intuitively, I just felt like, you know what, now I need to finish this now. And so that's when I sort of stepped on the gas, and that resulted in it coming out last week. And I feel like for whatever reason, my, you know, it's meant to be. Boy, the collection of songs, it's hard to know where to start. They were written for many different reasons in many different contexts, and they slowly fell together in this record. And I feel like, again, there is a hidden logic to it. The fact that they are all together now on this record and making a journey of sorts, there's certainly a lot of shared themes. So even though I had different things in mind when I was writing all these songs, I think they are related.
This is only the second time in your career that you have worked with another producer. You normally self-produce your albums. What was going on that made you want to invite another participant into this one?
You know, I've just made so many records on my own. So I feel like I've thoroughly explored everything I have to offer and then some. And looking back, you know, I mean, I guess there was a different reasons involved, you know. I mean, a big one was just the speed that I was moving at. For decades, I just couldn't be bothered to call the professionals and wait for them, put together and work, you know, again, like working even with this one person on this record was excruciating for me, right. You know, having to hold up the process and herd cats and all of that. So, I mean, that was one factor as to why I just always did it on my own, just to do it and be done and move on and whatever. But I've done that so many times, and more recently in my life, it started with bringing in a mixer. My last couple of records, I didn't mix myself for the first time, and bringing in an Ace mixer was revelating to me. I was like, wow, whoa, okay, right. You can record the damn thing, you know, write it and sing it and play it and record it. And then you can up the ante even more mixing it, which is something I could never do on my own because I'm so, you know, my objectivity is gone and I'm so deep in it and I have all these preconceived notions. So I was, after having a mixer for the last few records, I thought, why didn't I do that earlier? So sure. This is the next step for me, a producer. Like, yeah, let me find somebody who can really participate in every way with me on a record, you know, make the big decisions. Like, is this recording too slow? Is this, you know, should it be in a different key? Should I play a different instrument? Should we take the guitar away altogether, which is something BJ sort of opted to do a lot on this record, which is counterintuitive for me because I'm best friends with my guitar, you know? So a lot of the songs on this record, the guitar is just kind of turned into a different sound by BJ. So anyway, I just thought, yeah, I want somebody else in the cockpit, so to speak, you know, helping me drive for a change.
Unprecedented Shit is the title of the album. As we've mentioned, it's also the name of one of the songs, and I want to share part of it with the listening audience, with bleeps where needed. What does this song mean to you? What is some of the unprecedented shit that you have faced and wanted to convey in this song?
I mean, I almost hate to narrow it down because it applies to so many things, you know, and every listener has their version, I think, you know. I mean, we all just lived through a pandemic, and unless you were alive in 1918, we've all been through unprecedented challenges and changes and, you know, crises. I mean, start with the climate crisis. I mean, and continue on ad infinitum. You know, I think there's a real, real direct threat to our democracy, or the very underpinnings of our society that we are very blessed to be born into. And it's as fragile as anything that seems so concrete, you know. So that song is meant to speak to, you know, fill in the blank.
I got a lot of heart, but I can't afford to let it bleed. I can't afford to empathize, compromise, or concede. And I don't want to hear about it when the cold has reached your bones. I'm just thinking about that drink I'm gonna crack when I get back home. Yes, I'm just thinking about that drink I'm gonna crack when I get back home. Cause in this job I have seen some unprecedented shit, and I don't know if I have whatever this is. Whatever this is.
The song New Bible sounds different to me in a way that I can't put my finger on. Can you explain the sound and then the meaning and message of that song for you?
Yeah, well, maybe it's because I'm playing ukulele. It's the only song I've ever written on ukulele. So there you go.
That'll do it.
It's a pretty straight up recording. That one was less BJ-fied than other songs on the record. I mean, I guess, you know, it's just a song about sort of stepping back and questioning it all. Capitalism, patriarchy, you know, all the fundamentals that we're dealing with, and really trying to shake free some new creativity around it all. Reproductive freedom, for starters. I really feel that that is not just about women's freedom and civil rights in my mind. It's really about step one to solving all of these social and political issues, you know? So that's why it factors heavily into this song, New Bible, because I think we have to start with free women to get to peace on earth, you know, because women and men, all genders, need to be at the table together, at the design table, you know, for the right design to be created. You know, that's sort of the, finds its way to the center of that song. You know, we need to start there with inclusion, you know, emancipation of women, inclusion of all of us, and then we figure it out together.
If that nurse don't get you, then her sister will, with her Monday through Sunday dispenser pills. Don't know which of my habits will be my demise, but there's more ways every day to betray what is wise. It troubles the body, all this hidden pollution, making some kind of cancer, foregone conclusion. And deep in my saddlebags I carry a rage for the greedy top feeders in their invisible cage. Oh, rise the proletariat, red banners unfurl. Let's mend the failures of history and the man-made world. Let's mend the failures of the profit system. Let's rewrite the law books. Quit following the path of least resistance, 'cause that's what makes the real crooked. Let's evolve into our true nature, so little flowers can't bloom in a world where relationship is sacred and sacrifice is assumed. All for one and one for all. Boom, chicka boom, boom, boom.
That's part of New Bible by our guest Ani DeFranco from her album Unprecedented. Now available on Righteous Babe Records. You are incredibly, incredibly busy right now. You've been busy for decades, but you're also incredibly busy right now. You're making your Broadway debut through June 30th as Persephone in Anais Mitchell's Hades Town, which you sang that role on the original concept album in 2010.
6 feet under, getting under your skin. Cabin fever is setting in. Yeah, you're stir crazy. You're stuck in a rut, or you could use a little pick me up. I can give you what it is you crave, a little something from the good old days. I got the wind right here in a jar. I got the rain on tap at the bar. I got sunshine up on a shelf. Allow me to introduce myself. Brother, what's my name? My name is
Our Lady of the Underground.
Brother, what's my name?
Our Lady of Waves, Our Lady of Me.
Brother, what's my name? My name is
Our Lady of the Upside Down.
Brother, what's my name? I'll tell you my name. Persephone.
What is it like beyond Broadway? Was it something that you saw for yourself at any point before it was happening?
I mean, I started rehearsals in January, and it's been completely kicking my ass. It's been really fun. I really love the people, the cast, all the people involved. It's a really wonderful vibe there at the Walter Kerr Theater over on 48th Street. Everyone has everyone's back. It's a lot of really dynamic, brilliant, kind, supportive, mutually respectful tribe, you know? And so I've been super blessed to be a part of it. And, you know, I think the work is brilliant. Hadestown is a brilliant piece of writing. And so I feel proud to be carrying the role of Persephone and making it come to life every night. But it's also just, wow, 8 shows a week is a crazy life to live. The Broadway life, you know, and, you know, most of the cast, I look around and they're all, not all, but a lot of them are half my age, you know, which
yep,
is,
that will help.
It seems like, yeah, it seems like the only way to, it's possible. I am just hanging on by my fingernails to the 8 show a week gauntlet. And, but everybody around me, I look around and everybody is just counting the moments to the end of that last Sunday show. We have Mondays off. It's our one day a week. And so it's really grueling. But I'm really glad that I signed up for a full 6 months, you know, and feel like I'm really in it. I'm really living the life and learning how challenging it really is.
Did you need to learn things that you don't typically learn for performance, like choreography and blocking? And
yeah,
who teaches you that when you're taking over a role that has been running?
I mean, there is a battalion of leaders, bosses. For somebody like me who's never had a boss in my, well, since I was a teenager,
mm-hmm,
early 20s, working day jobs, it's been really humbling. They are so specific, so exacting. So that was a really new thing for me, compared to my life in performance up till now, which was super self-directed and intuitive, you know, the way I move, what I say, how I interface with the audience. And I tend to approach it really improvisationally when I'm doing me. Mm-hmm. This is a whole other bag of donuts, you know. It's extremely scripted, of course, and very specific, you know. So the rehearsal month was just a shock. I was in shock in so many ways. Like, oh, wow, point your finger. Nope, a little lower. Nope, a little high, you know, on
wow,
beat
yeah,
2 of measure 3. And on this word, turn your head. Nope, too far. You know, just, oh, my goodness. You know, this is, you know, when I walked out on my opening night, my head was just swimming with 10,000 instructions for every moment. And I had to, you know, it was a real process to overcome all that instruction and that cacophony of voices that had filled my head for a month and try to get back to that place of being intuitive and natural and bringing myself to it, you know.
You yeah, did sing the role on the original concept album, but if I'm right about the track listing, your first number in the show, as you're playing Persephone now, Living It Up on Top, wasn't part of that one, right? Wasn't part of the
That's
original?
That's right, yeah.
All right, so you,
yeah,
what do you... That's probably my favorite song in Hadestown. I mean, I love a lot of them, of course, but I love that introduction to Persephone. I love that song, the energy of it, the sound of it. Are you enjoying performing that one?
Yeah, yeah, totally. That one's a lot of dancing for me,
yeah,
which is really fun. It's a very old muscle that was very out of shape when I showed up here in New York. So it's really cool to pull that out of my deep, dark past. I thought I was going to be a dancer when I was a kid. That was where my heart was. And then it sort of moved into music by the time I was a young adult. But so it's like a really old love that I've rekindled.
Has your family or any close friends come to see you in Hadestown? And what do they think about watching you, who they know so well, perform a different character on a Broadway show?
Yeah, yeah, my brother and his wife and my mother just came. It was my mom's 91st birthday.
Oh, wow.
She came, and the whole cast, they were so sweet. After the show, we gathered in the theater and they all sang happy birthday to her. They're so, so kind. So it was incredible for her, you know. I think she had a great time. But yeah, it's really funny for people that know me, you know, to just see me step on stage in heels and a dress and a wig and all this makeup. And It's ridiculous what I look like in this production, which is funny to me because most of the people on stage dress like I've dressed for 30 years, you know,
right.
Very low key combat boots and dirty t-shirts and, you know, and so it's funny that I am the looking the way I am.
Right. The gussied up one.
yeah. Sparkly. But yeah, that was another thing that just took me a while to acclimate to, you know, I would have these just moments of kind of personal crisis for the first bunch of weeks that I was doing the show of like, I just look down and think, what am I doing? what is going on? But now, you know, you get used to it. And now I just step into Persephone's dress and wig and I step out on stage and I get it now. I'm not Ani. It's not about what is Ani doing. It's Persephone time. And I just go all the way there.
One more thing before I let you, you know, get some rest before your performance tonight. You have a new kids book coming out in August called Show Up and Vote. Tell us about this book, please.
I love the artwork. I love Rochelle's art. It's so spunky and colorful and full of life. And yeah, it's what it sounds like. It's a book about voting, which I just feel like as children, you don't know necessarily or intuitively that citizenship is a part of being a grown-up. That's a kind of an elusive aspect. It's not something that you see modeled every day necessarily, but I think it's really important that kids do that. I mean, I take my kids to vote with me. I usually vote in person if I can, and bring my kids so that they see it, so that they understand it as an important part of being grown. And I wanted to make a book that could help parents and kids talk about it, engage about voting and what it is and why it is, and maybe even get kids excited about doing it themselves someday.
That was singer-songwriter Ani DeFranco speaking with WAMC's Sarah LaDuke. DeFranco is starring as Persephone in the Tony and Grammy Award-winning Best Musical Hadestown through June 30th. Our next guest has a dance career spanning three decades of study and performances in cities across the U.S. Amy Jordan is a one-time dancer, now choreographer, who founded the Victory Dance Project in 2014. She's trained in classical ballet, jazz, modern dance, and hip-hop, but her career in dance nearly came to an end after she was hit by a New York City bus in 2009. Jordan was lucky to survive the crash, let alone walk or dance again. But after a years-long journey toward recovery, she formed her dance company with a mission of making the impossible possible with the power of movement. Jordan celebrated her own victory dance on stage with the group in 2017. Now the company is preparing to celebrate its 10-year anniversary with a performance in Jordan's Florida hometown on June 22nd. In a recent conversation with Jordan, she told me she doesn't really remember the crash that started it all, but she remembers the resolve that came from it.
I didn't really know what was going on at the time, and I practiced SGI Nietzsche and Buddhism, and I immediately started chanting Nam-myo Renge Kyo because I had no idea what was happening. I had no feeling on my right side. And my first thought, as the story goes, is that I'll never dance again. And, you know, as an SGI Buddhist, it's all about creating value from any situation. Now, we're never a victim of circumstance. So fortunately, that had been embedded in my being. And even in that moment of crisis and life and death situation, I thought, if I survive, there'll be a victory dance. Everything in Buddhism is about creating victory from any obstacle. And this was a significantly large obstacle. I really had no idea what was ahead of me, obviously. And that vow came to fruition 5 years later with the premiere show of the Victory Dance Project at the Alvin Ailey Center for Dance here in New York. And The mission of the company is to make the impossible possible with the power of movement. Now, we're all, whether you dance or not, we're moving through everything. That's, we move through life, we move through challenges, we move through our day. So it's really become a metaphor for creating victory in any moment, which we can choose to do. You don't have to get crushed by a bus. You know, don't do that. I did that. So I don't recommend it.
For the company's 10th anniversary show, you're revisiting your signature performance, which is called Human Revolution. I just really liked that idea and that title, Human Revolution. Could you tell me a little bit more about what that means to you and how you explore it in this performance?
Human Revolution is a very well-used term within the SGI Buddhist community, and it's really about taking personal responsibility, that we don't have to seek anything outside of ourselves. If we really are willing to face our lives head on, do the work, you know, everything is a result of cause and effect. So everything we do is a cause and it renders an effect. So if we want to change ourselves, our environment, our financial, our relational, our health situations, we need to be willing to look at where we are and then make a different cause. So with the Human Revolution work at the time, it's a 25-minute contemporary ballet in 5 sections. I brought in the idea of a hat. I mean, as an artist, the audience is going to take it how, absorb it in their own way. But for me, it really represented the respect of the life of the main character in the work. And she's struggling to respect her own life. She's addicted to an unhealthy situation. There's a song literally called Addicted by Kelly Clarkson, where we go on this journey with her where she just can't quite stand up for herself. As women, we go through this a lot with the boundaries. She keeps going back to this situation. And I exemplified that through the choreography. We watch her really fight to have the dignity and respect for her own life, and all the way to the very end when, spoiler alert, she wins, she gets the hat. But until we're willing to do the emotional and work and make a different cause, the situation's not going to change. So she's doing her human revolution. She doesn't want to keep going back to this destructive pattern, but until we face it and are willing to do something about it, it's not going to change. So that's my goal with it. You know, people are going to interpret it how they interpret it, but it had a very specific set of music choices, a very specific set of casting choices as we follow her journey. So that's our signature work. We're showing it again. I brought it back out and dusted it off with a new cast, which has been fun.
I was going to ask, what's it been like to revisit it 10 years later? You know, has your relationship changed to it at all?
I definitely have a different perspective on the work, and I've had some time away from it. I was able to look at the video just from a dance perspective of things that I wanted to, I don't want to say fix, but evolve. Obviously, with a new cast, I've hired dancers in Florida, which is my hometown. So it was really important to me to bring in the local community. And then I have these amazing men coming in from Pace University Commercial Dance in New York. They're all flying in, and, you know, with different personalities, it's the same basic work, but obviously these artists bring in their own history and their own perspectives. And it's been fun to reset it and give them the opportunity, because as dancers, in order for them, you know, we're also actors in a way. So in order for these girls to rise to the occasion of the work, they have to really understand the story and what it is. So I'm hoping that it will encourage them, because they're so young, you know, like, respect the dignity of your life. You don't have to be so affected by our external environment. You know, one of the pieces is really about, we're affected by our outside, especially now with social media. Our environment reflects ourselves, right? So we're always complaining and blaming, and that's just everywhere because it gets ad revenue and ratings. But at the end of the day, if we transform from the inside, our external world will transform. And we see that with her through the different sections.
Well, I know it might not be top of mind with the show around the corner, but what's next for Victory Dance Project after this? Do you have any other projects in the works?
We have a lot happening, actually. I've got a few. September 21st is National Dance Day. I'll be doing a class at the Square in West Palm Beach. I also have created a lifestyle and apparel brand called Victory Gear, which I'm very excited about. I'm all about wear it, live it, love your scars, wear your hot pants, deformed leg or not. And so there's some things happening fashion-wise. I have some guest artist spots that I'm working on. I really enjoy teaching a young pre-professional level dance, university level. And we're, you know, just want to continue now more than ever about this making the impossible possible with the power movement. And really, dance because you can, I say, to every audience.
Amy Jordan is a public speaker, author, choreographer, and founder and artistic director of the Victory Dance Project, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary with a performance in West Palm Beach, Florida, on June 22nd. You can learn more at victorydance.org. Amy, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Finally, Opera Saratoga in New York's Capital Region is in the middle of its annual summer festival, set to run through July 7th. It's the organization's 62nd season, and second undergeneral and artistic director Mary Birnbaum, who also teaches at the Juilliard School. Our associate producer Jody Cowan recently spoke with Birnbaum about her approach to opera, specifically how to balance classic opera and modern musical theater, and when to blur the line between the two.
The part of the process that you can control, I always think, is the part where you're on your own preparing, right? So I do kind of the same steps every time to get to the first day of rehearsal with a little bit of variance depending on who's producing the show or who the designers are, because I have a very intensive design process. Usually with opera or with world premieres, you're working with the designers for a couple years or a year, you know, at the least, beforehand to bring the project to fruition so that you can arrive at the first day of rehearsal and say, okay, here's the world we're creating. Here are the costumes. Here's the characters. Here's what we're thinking about the way we're going to tell the story. And that process is exciting, really exciting to work with the designers. And then when I get into the room, every actor has a different language. And you think usually I do know a couple of them going in. That's the virtue of having done this for a while. But sometimes I don't, and I'm sort of learning a language to communicate with someone in real time. And I read at some point that a beautiful quote was that a director's job is the container to make people feel free to create within. And I think that also takes making sure everyone feels heard with the way they communicate. I do know now, you know, in a directing process, I know that I'll usually feel excited the first week, a little freaked out the second week, miraculously restored the third week, and the same process during tech. So the first night is kind of exciting because you're discovering. The second night is like, oh no, nothing's going right. So it starts to replicate itself. And there are, of course, like mitigating circumstances and everything, but you have to trust that you'll arrive at opening with whatever's meant to happen. Same thing is true when actors drop out or singers drop out in the last minute or designers need to leave or whatever. You have to trust that whoever's meant to do the piece will do it.
A couple of interesting things that I've learned about you is your fondness for the use of sleight of hand and stage magic in your storytelling.
I'm interested in making the experience of the audience way more interactive from the beginning of the ticket buying process so that the story that they're being told is echoed in all of the ways they're being communicated with. The same thing is true with the artists. So like, is there a way to get the artists to be more integral to the creative process and for them to be able to generate ideas on their own? It's a little bit of thinking of the rehearsal process as the first step, but then the creative process as growing out from that and thinking of like other ways in which performance can kind of serve us. I don't know if this makes sense, but I'll give you an example. Just after the pandemic, a friend of mine who runs Virginia Opera called and said, I have a really crazy idea. What if we do a Wagner opera, that's Rheingold, outside on Topgolf, which is a driving range that is 400 feet deep and has several like bays in it where audiences can sit. And I said, well, that sounds amazing. Yes, I'm in, obviously. It was like logistically a very challenging thing. The orchestra had to be in an air-conditioned room inside the thing. And so we couldn't even have direct contact with them. It was wild. But, and the show ended up having golf carts in it and we used all the mechanisms of the golf course. But the point was that the audience had an experience that was unlike any other and completely unreplicable, and the ephemerality of it is actually a virtue in a way, because it's something so special that they can then take with them. That actually, that production did have magic, directed by Jeff Koenig, who is a magician who works in New York and really special artist. And he interwove the magic, because there's a sorcerer character, sort of a wizard character. He interwove the magic into his staging. So anyway, that thinking about how can this be a totally unique night in your life, or how can this deliver something to you that you didn't even know was possible from the show? And that has less to do with technology than we might think, right? It has less to do with like the Vegas sphere or the incredible 360 projections of an immersive room or whatever. I really believe that the reason why people need to go to the theater, and the reason why we, those who love it, is the personal connection and the space you feel inside of with the actors, the intimate, the sort of intimate relationship that you form when you're watching somebody else live out a story. So I don't know that that's advancing, but it certainly feels to me like the freshest thing that I can work on, especially in a time when we're all staring at screens all day.
You're currently the general and artistic director of Opera Saratoga. How has your craft evolved in your current position as you prepare for the summer stage season?
Well, the coolest thing about the Capital Region is how many amazing arts organizations there are. It's a feast. It's from SPAC to Albany Symphony to Albany Pro Musica to Cafe Lena to RPI MPAC to the Hyde Collection to Troy Savings Bank Music Hall. Like, don't even get, I mean, really, truly, I'm just like spouting out the first 10 names that came to mind. But my first goal was, get in touch with all these places. How can we collaborate? What can we make together? We have to figure out something that will serve both constituencies and also like energize the people who love the arts here. And I think the thing about opera that's so wonderful is that it's the complete art form. That's what people say. It's like, it's got music, it's got text, it's got acting, it's got dance, it's got art, visual art. And you can put all of those things in it so that when I'm looking for collaborators, I can really look way beyond the scope of like just opera companies, which is actually crazy because there is no other opera company in the Capital Region. We're the only one. So I knew that coming out of this time, this COVID time for this, for Opera Saratoga, that we needed to become a community service organization, not just thinking about it as a place where we're producing things, but as a place where we're running programs. Our education program is running a piece called Katie, the Strongest of the Strong, which has everything to do with strong women. We also run a program called Songs by Heart, which is for Alzheimer's and people afflicted with Alzheimer's and dementia, which we take, where we take singers to memory care facilities, and a singer and a pianist sings with people who are in various states of dementia, and for an hour leads them in community movement and mirroring, and we call it a therapeutic music program. But the room awakens, like you see the vibrations hitting these people and they start to remember songs from their youth. And it's the most moving thing. So we run that program, the education program, and also a recital program at Cafe Lena intended for BIPOC singers to hand them the mic and get to curate their own recital. In the summer, we run this festival, which is three main stages and like 17 other concerts, I think. And we aim to bring joy and inspiration to the region via big shows, which feature professional artists from beyond and are supplemented with festival artists, who are sort of this emerging round of artists that we've auditioned out of I think out of 1,000 people, we hired 21 of them this year. So they're really special people. And they're fantastic singers. So we work at UPH, at Universal Preservation Hall, in the summer. But in the rest of the year, we're hopefully all over the place. So my craft has not changed, but my network really has. And my desire to make things for the community upstate and things that they particularly care about is really high on the list. Somebody last year said, what about Guys and Dolls? Which I thought, you know, at the beginning, I thought, oh, well, that's a really tricky sell for an opera company. It's like, that's a, you know, it would be a bridge. However, then you listen to Guys and Dolls and you hear Adelaide's Lament, which I get off at Saratoga for the 14th time because it's all, and it starts with a few Cretin horns that's all about horse racing is the beginning of the show. And I thought, wait, this is a brilliant idea. We should do it in conjunction with the crowd in Saratoga, particularly that Belmont is going to be here this year. That actually feels like an aesthetic fit and a fit for what people are actually, what's on their mind in the first place. So I think programming is a little bit of waiting for the community to speak and to see what is really needed and what people really want in an experience at the theater. I would also say, like, I've been reminded of the power of joy and that a place that the live performing arts really can serve is uplift. And last summer we did two comedies. This summer we're doing two comedies. And I'm not to say that they're not relevant or provocative or, you know, that you won't leave with something to talk about, but I really think it's a service we can do in these times right now. I mean, you read about orchestral musicians in places of war kind of going to hospitals and playing. Like, this is a hard time, I think, in the world, and we're here to provide something that takes you out of that for at least a couple hours.
That was Mary Birnbaum, General and Artistic Director for Opera Saratoga, speaking with our associate producer, Jody Cowan. Opera Saratoga's Summer Festival runs through July 7th. You can learn more at operasaratoga.org. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Jody Cowan, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. We'll be breaking down the Supreme Court's ruling on mifepristone. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and on the hall.